Gozer the Gozerian? Good evening. As a duly designated representative of the city, county, and state of New York, I order you to cease any and all supernatural activity and return forthwith to your place of origin or to the nearest convenient parallel dimension.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
Welcome to the Three Film Egos. I'm your hirsute host, Isaac Jensen, and with me as always is Utah's whitest black child, Clayton Godby.
They should have both been kicked by horses.
And our resident vegan dreadlocked Portlandier, Ryan Cragen.
You can walk around naked and it won't be the bad naked.
This is a film discussion podcast where we each pick a film based on a predetermined theme or topic and then talk about anything but. There will be tangents. There will not be spoiler alerts. Consider yourselves warned. On this episode, ghosts.
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 Ooh.
Goats.
Ghost.
All right. Who's gonna lead?
Who wants to start with this one?
Empire of Passion.
What was my pick?
Let's see. Empire. Oh, I remember Empire of Passion. Okay.
Oh yeah. I could start. Empire of Passion might be a good place to start.
That was Isaac's. Yours is Carnival
Your pick
of Souls.
Was a, yeah.
Did I pick Carnival of Souls?
You did.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, then you could start with Empire of Passion. I don't know. See, Empire of Passion seems like a movie I would have picked because I liked it so much.
Yeah. Well, I say we start with Empire of Passion. That's going to be Isaac.
All right. Empire of Passion, it's a Japanese film, a ghost story by director Nagisa Oshima, who's someone I've kind of discovered earlier this year and have just really taken an affinity to, almost eclipsing Kurosawa in my favorite Japanese director, just because his films are so out there and, are more artsy and explore probably deeper, social subjects than Kurosawa does. Yes, from 1978. Essentially, the story is about a couple who have a couple of kids. They kind of lead a poor existence. The husband carts around a rickshaw for a living, and he's gone lots of the day and comes home to the wife. The wife takes care of him, but the wife is kind of antagonized by a young man in town, and eventually he seduces her, kind of rapes her, and then convinces her that in order for them to be together, they have to kill the husband. And then cut to, like 3 years later, and the husband starts showing up again as a ghost and, essentially driving the woman mad, and they kind of reap all the consequences of those actions. And I think it's a beautiful film, very expressive. I think the cinematography is just breathtaking. And I think it's an interesting kind of twist on a ghost story, in that the ghost may not actually be real. It might just be a representation of guilt. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I like that. And I liked also that this was a ghost story that was maybe creepy. There were some creepy moments, but the ghost didn't seem to pose any physical threat when he would appear. He was just kind of there and kind of demanded things. But it was a much more tame presence than most Americanized ghost stories, where the ghost comes back and has some little sinister intentions. And I liked that about this story.
Yeah, I definitely saw the ghost as a representation of guilt. It's the constant reminder of the acts that she and, the young man did, dumping his body down the well.
That's an interesting way to think about it. I was curious why the story skipped 3 years, why it would be 3 years later that either a ghost or a feeling of guilt would come up. And I find it interesting the way they represented the passage of time throughout the movie, not only in the three-year gap, but at any change of season. It was very abrupt, and very use of colors was a big part of the way they represented a passage of time. I thought that was interesting, but I wasn't sure why he waited so long to come back.
Well, I think it might have something to do with how the town started talking a lot about the situation, and maybe it's because in that day, this is supposed to take place in the late 1890s. Maybe it was not unusual for a husband to disappear for a few years for work and just, send money home. But, you know, after 3 years, it's maybe, you know, maybe there was something going on. Maybe, you know, the husband's actually dead and these guys killed them. So with everyone else kind of harping on the woman about it, maybe it brought it, you know, into her mind more. She started, you know, really feeling the guilt that started to manifest through this ghost.
Right. The walls started closing in.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the more interesting points of this is you can't really feel any sympathy for the main characters here, the woman and the young man, because the husband didn't do anything to deserve what came to him.
Yeah, he was completely innocent.
Well, I don't know if he was a good man. I mean, it's fair to say that he pretty much ignored his wife and just got hammered all the time.
Yeah.
So, but I think those were devices to give, you know, so you can see somewhat of a motivation for the wife, so you can kind of see why she would do something like that. I mean, she obviously might feel alienated from her husband, and it's nice to finally get attention from this young guy, you know, that thinks she looks way younger and is giving her everything she desires. And so she just kind of uses it as a scapegoat, you know. It's justification for her actions, but then once people start asking questions and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, but there is definitely a sense that she got duped into doing the whole thing. Like, at no point did she really seem 100% willing to go along with it. Like, even the act of the murder, she feels she's extremely just being pushed into it because, I don't know, maybe she's stupid. I mean, they kind of talk about that earlier, about how she didn't really have the brights. She, you know, she didn't want to lead this kind of life, but really felt like she had no choice.
Well, the younger guy kind of pushes her around. I mean, he more or less rapes her, you know, and takes control of her. And she seems somewhat willing. She kind of gives in.
Yeah, there's definitely that moment in the middle of the rape scene where you can see that it has changed from something that she's completely against to something she finds some degree of pleasure in. That was just a weird scene to me. Like, it seems so odd, but it was well acted, and then it ends up being an integral part of the plot.
Yeah, I never deal with rape scenes well. This one was particularly strange.
We've done a lot of movies with rape in it so far. So like every other episode, we're talking about a rape scene or something.
Well, a lot of the movies we pick happen to have those as plot devices, so I don't really blame us. We're not seeking out rape scenes. I mean, it's a whole different episode, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But the fact that we keep revisiting it means maybe that, you know, unconsciously we are drawn to that. I don't know.
I am not. I hope not. I definitely wasn't expecting anything that I saw in this movie. I just rolled with it.
Yeah, I came to this one just because I had seen several films, earlier films by the same director, and it was just, you know, next one on my list. Yeah, I just loved it. Like, I especially loved the shots from inside the well.
Yeah, that's on the cover. Yeah, that's on the cover of the movie. Actually, it's that shot. It's great.
And then how at the end it does the twist where they're down there trying to find the body. And I guess I should probably explain that. You know, earlier in the film, the young man, after they kill the husband, they throw him down a well, and the young man every fall travels to the well, gathers a bunch of leaves, and throws it down into the well to further bury it. And after they finally decide they need to dig up the body, find it, get you know, fully rid of it so they could be, you know, not found guilty of murder, they go down to the well, start digging, and then we see the same shot that we've seen a few times prior to in the movie from inside the well looking up to the opening of the well, and the ghost peers his head over the ledge and starts dropping leaves on them, and it's just so creepy, but so awful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my favorite parts of the story. Definitely a great scene.
Yeah, and I think the reason I feel like we can't feel sympathy for these people, well, I mean, it's because the way I look at it, even though the husband might have been a drunk, it seemed like he was, I don't know, we weren't really shown any hard evidence that he wasn't, for all intents and purposes, you know, a devoted husband and father. I mean, he worked hard, he provided for family, and I think you see some scenes with him playing with the kids. Yeah, but then he gets, you know, shithoused and passes out, so he might have been neglectful. But other than that, you know, I don't feel like there was any real motivation other than the woman got duped into sleeping with the young man, and then he forces her to shave herself, which would expose the affair to the husband, so then convinces her to kill him. And so we can't feel that empathy for them throughout the story. Otherwise, when they get their comeuppance at the end, you might not feel it's justified in a certain degree, when it totally is.
Yeah, they're definitely not the heroes of the story, despite the fact that they're the protagonists of the story.
Yeah.
They're almost the villains of their own story, and you watch them, and you never feel like they're good people. It's always like covering up for the past and trying to find more lies and things like that, and worrying about their own well-being. And the mother ends up not really being a very great mother.
Right.
So I see what you're saying there.
Yeah, and plus I really love movies with anti-heroes. I mean, they're not even really that. Just I like seeing explorations of the darker sides of humanity, the kind of exploration of the more base and carnal instincts that most of us suppress.
I mean, if we break down basically what's happening here, I mean, it's essentially you have people that are hiding their secrets, and eventually they feel guilty about what they're hiding, you know, in their deep, dark well, and, you know, it comes back to haunt them. At least that's what I took out of it. I didn't think it was much more deep than that.
No, it's a simple story.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty much what it was trying to say to me anyway. I thought some of the characters were nice. I thought really the style of the movie that it was shot was probably my favorite part of it.
Yeah.
I thought the shots inside the house and just kind of the set decoration when they have the you know, the fires in the house, and just kind of I wonder how accurate that was to how living in that time period in Japan was. You know, I wonder how authentic it really was. I've seen a lot of period pieces, but how many of them do you think are actually legitimately close to reality?
Hard to tell. I have no way of knowing. I'm not a historian mm-hmm. or anything, but
right. I think most of them strive for a certain degree of accuracy, but when it comes to like set design and style, there's got to be a little bit of an exaggeration, you know, to maybe heighten the sense of what it might be like. So it might not necessarily be an exact representation of what it was like in that time. It might be a hyperbolized sense of that, but it felt authentic to me.
Yeah, and that's what it did for me too, and that's why I think I liked it so much. It kind of felt like this is real people happening. I mean, it gets surreal when you have a ghost showing up with kind of iffy effects. But, all in all, it was definitely, I don't know, it felt real.
Mm-hmm. Especially when the kind of newly westernized police force showed up to investigate. Mm-hmm. And the kind of power-tripping police chief guy.
I also liked about this movie at some parts I liked it, and at some parts I didn't like it, just because I typically really dislike voiceover and I'm annoyed by it, but in the context of this movie it made it feel more like an oral history kind of ghost legend that had been passed down from ancestors or something, and that in this context and the time period that it's coming from, I did kind of enjoy just the way the story was told with the interjection of a storyteller now and then.
Yeah, I mean, it was especially prominent when it jumps forward to 3 years, and you kind of, you probably wouldn't know that happened unless there was that piece of voiceover. But yeah, that's interesting. It does feel like a parable, like you're being told a ghost story to prevent you from behaving badly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I definitely want to see some more of this guy's movies.
And I have, I think it was almost a year ago, Isaac told me to check him out, and I watched a very different film from this. What was it? Japanese Summer Double Suicide, I think it was called.
Yeah.
That's one that you told me that I'd really enjoy, and I liked it, but it's completely different. Completely,
yeah, that's,
you know, surrealist, like art film kind of stuff.
Yeah. It feels like Godard, that film in particular, with his use of like jump cuts and just surrealist situations.
It reminded me a little of Fellini too.
Of what?
Of Fellini a little bit. I was reminded.
Oh. Yeah, but I've seen, I think 8 of his films now, and they each have their own distinct feel and style. And I think I've read he actually strives to change it up with each new film. He doesn't want to do the same thing over again.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of his discography, or his filmography, is is documentary. So
really,
yeah, it looks the majority of his titles are documentary pieces.
Yeah, I think he got his start in documentary.
Interesting director. I'd like to see more, especially the one he did immediately before this, I believe, in the Realm of the Senses.
Yes,
that one I'd be.
I've seen it, and it's an extremely interesting experience. So I definitely want to see that with you guys, but I also don't want to say anything else about it.
Right, yeah.
I'm going to imagine it's pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
It's been called kind of a companion film, these two to be kind of similar in theme, but I also won't say anything else that I've heard about it.
Well, it's NC-17. I know that, so so I'm sure. I mean, I don't give a shit about ratings. I can just imagine that is a warning that's to come.
Yeah, both that one and Empire of Passion were a French-Japanese co-production under the same producer, so that might be why they're companion pieces. They have kind of a similar feel, but I'd say the experience of each is wholly different.
They're in completely different time periods, I imagine, and right?
Well,
I mean,
they're not too far off. I think,
not really.
Yeah, and the Realm of the Senses is 1920s, I think. I don't know. We'll get to that one.
We'll get that to
one
that one, yeah.
That one could be a whole episode on its own, I think.
Awesome.
All right.
Well,
so where to next? Carnival of Souls or Ghostbusters? Where do you want to go?
Maybe we should finish with Ghostbusters. Maybe I should introduce Carnival of Souls now.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm picking that too, yeah.
Cool. Carnival of Souls is my pick because I've heard a lot about it. It's kind of a local thing. A lot of people around here in Utah because it's set in Utah and leans heavily upon some real Utah landmarks and sites. A lot of people like it around here. And I was interested because it's Criterion. And really, I hadn't seen it before, but I kind of really liked it. Some of the acting's awful and really laughable. But I liked the general idea of this place that's of interest and this woman that's kind of haunted by a traumatic experience. She drives her car off of a bridge, and ever since that happens, she's kind of got this relationship with spirits and ghosts, and strange things start happening. And I like that idea of kind of like a residue of a rush with death, like leaving a remnant of death with you that you see in some horror films. But and it was kind of fun. The place where the Carnival of Souls takes place is a real place called the Saltaire in Utah, and I've been out there for concerts and things, and it's a cool, strange-looking building. And so for me, that added a little bit to the film. But yeah, that's pretty much why I picked it.
That building's so out of place. in the middle of nowhere. I've heard stories that it used to actually be. I've heard family members, you know, talk about. You know, they're old now, but they've talked about when there was actually salt water that came up to the Saltaire, and it was a park. And then the lake, the level went down, and you basically ended up with this giant building in a park in the middle of salt flats, in the middle of nowhere. I'm glad they didn't tear it down.
Definitely. It's a cool place. It looks like it has been a cool place throughout the whole time that it's been there. It first started out just being like a really fancy destination spot, like hotel or something, and then it became a carnival, like a real carnival. And then for a couple decades, there was just like creepy, weird carnival stuff out there. And that, I think, is when this film was made. And then now it's been like revamped several times. And right now they hold concerts there. The Flaming Lips played there just last week, actually. I wanted to go, but I couldn't.
Yeah,
but
it's a perfect place for the Flaming Lips.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty genius place to shoot a movie because I think you need a venue kind of creepy like that to shoot a movie like this. So I wonder if they wrote the script based off of the location or if they just found the location based off the script.
I've wondered that too, and I kind of feel like they may have written this movie around wanting to use the creepy carnival place that's there, which maybe isn't the best way to come to a movie. Or come to the decision of making a movie, but it worked out because I think the scenes where you are at the Saltaire and you are at the creepy carnival with souls chasing the protagonist around were cool, and I'm glad that they've been filmed and documented and that you can see what the Saltaire used to be.
Brett, actually, it was budget constraints that made them film in Utah. I don't know if that was their original plan, but
really,
so I don't know which came first. It's probably really cheap to shoot in Utah at the time, but it definitely served the movie well that it did end up being in Utah, because that Saltaire is probably one of the best places to have bulls chasing after you. You know, I've seen this a couple of times now, and it's horrible. It's not that good. I actually found myself getting kind of bored the second time through. Like the first time, I definitely was in it because of the Utah connection and how that was interesting to see. And I do love cheesy horror flicks like this. So I'm not saying it was not enjoyable. It's just not very well put together. Like I found there was some weird editing problems. Like there'd be that creepy organ music going through a scene, and all of a sudden it would just stop.
I was really bothered some of the times when it would show, because she's an organist in the script, and she comes to Utah to play organ in a church, and so sometimes the creepy organ music, it would show her playing the organ, and when it didn't line up, or it was supposed to be this escalated thing, like she's playing crazy music, and a priest comes and is like, "What are you doing playing that crazy music?" And the music wouldn't line up at all with what she was doing with her fingers. Certainly whatever she was playing was not a song and would have sounded anything like the soundtrack. I was bothered by that. When there's a lot of stuff like that in it.
Yeah, that happens a lot when there's music involved and people are supposed to be playing it in the movies. It never looks authentic, especially if you're a musician and you know what you're looking for, and it just takes you right out of the movie. It's like I don't know why they decide to show shots of the people playing the instruments when it's obvious they're not really playing. I mean, you can shoot from different angles and hide it.
Yeah. So. But then I'm also, because I'm always watching to see if someone's actually playing, I've also kind of gained a skill for feeling when they're placing the camera in a way where you won't be able to tell whether they're playing or not.
Right.
Like I kind of notice either way.
Either way, you're taken out of it.
Around it.
I totally agree. It's frustrating. The best is when you get shots of just hands on a piano, which obviously aren't the same hands of the actor that are playing it. So they cheat, right? They do a shot where you can't see the hands and it's the actor, and then you get a shot of hands, some weird man hands, just playing a piano.
There's a lot of ways to try to get around it. There's only one way to do it right.
This is probably shot where the scenes of her playing the organs were shot, and then the music was probably inserted over them. So it's not. She might have not even been playing along to anything.
Right.
And part of me knowing the geography of Utah a little bit better, sometimes I just found it a little ridiculous that she's looking out of her window in this house and she's seeing the Saltaire. just isn't possible because it's so far out in the middle of nowhere.
There
that
are no houses
you,
out there.
Yeah, you would never see any. You can't see the Saltaire unless you're right up next to it. But
yeah, but that actually didn't bother me too much because I was trying to look at it from the viewpoint of someone just watching the movie, and there'd be no way for the average person who's never been to Utah to know that.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, I understand. For the illusion for most people isn't going to be ruined at all.
Yeah.
It just is for me because I know where it was shot, which kind of makes me glad that I don't live places that frequently have movies shot there. Take me out of it. But
there's
all
actually
in all,
a lot of movies shot up here in Spokane, but they're never based in Spokane.
Right, they have that epic park up there, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They shoot a bunch of movies, and I imagine. All in all, in this movie, I found myself more drawn to just looking at the location than I was caring about any sort of story. I mean, I thought some of the dialogue between her and the kind of the roommate, the guy that's hitting on her the whole movie, I thought some of that was hilarious because it was just ridiculous. But you really
almost
don't have...
all of the dialogue was ridiculous, but those two especially.
Yeah, that was a little ridiculous.
Can you even taste that coffee anymore? Hey, I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to start the day off right. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I kind of wish that we could go back in time and go to Saltaire when it was like that, though.
Oh,
It's just so bizarre that there's so much stuff that was there that there's not even a trace of anymore. All those buildings and the actual carnival that doesn't exist at all.
Yeah, it's simply just the shell of the main building.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's like a big fence around it, and then, I don't know, and then the building. There's nothing else there now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I will acknowledge this film probably did influence future films. Like the look of the ghouls, mm-hmm. I think, shows up. I don't know if it's intentional, but kind of mirrors the same look of the ghouls in Night of the Living Dead.
Which is
shot way after, yeah. I mean, this movie's...
Yeah, it was like 6 or 7 years later. So, I don't know, maybe that was just the industry standard for, you know, cheap horror movie ghouls.
I hope that's a cheap ghoul. I mean, come on, they looked like actors with white paint on their face.
Yeah.
Nothing glorious about that at all.
Yeah, and none of the characters really felt authentic. I mean, it's probably a fault of the dialogue, but especially with the main character. I mean, I guess she was supposed to have kind of a haunted feel about her, but I really didn't get a sense at all of who she was or why she did anything she did.
No. And also, well, I was especially bothered by the psychiatrist dude. Or
yeah.
He said specifically he wasn't a psychiatrist, but I don't know why he was acting like one then. But that guy was so fake. He just like comes and like sees her at a water fountain and like, come with me to my office. It was just like the strangest.
He practically assaults her too.
Yeah, he's like holding her like, come on, you need help. I don't know if he didn't have enough work or what.
I'm sure that was it.
That guy was annoying, though. He was my least favorite character, and there was no reason for him to be there. Dr. Samuels, I guess, was the character name.
I don't know about that guy. I wasn't really fond of the landlord. I don't think I was really fond of any of the characters in this movie, to be honest. But I just don't imagine that this guy had a long writing career. I don't think he was very good at developing characters. I mean, I think he maybe just had this idea of, you know, somebody being haunted by ghouls in some carnival, and that was what he wrote.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah. But either way, I wasn't too bummed that I watched it.
No.
I've seen much worse movies than this, for sure.
Yeah, I think this one was actually trying to be anything great. I think it was just fun.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it looks like this is about the only story he ever wrote. The rest of the work he did was for like documentary shorts, and they made a remake of this movie in 98 where he's credited with the story. But
this is about
the only thing he ever wrote.
I'm sure the remake has got to be worse than this movie.
No, yeah, it's under Wes Craven.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I almost guarantee the remake is way worse than this movie.
I'd prefer to watch this.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'll ever watch this again, but I'd still prefer to watch it.
Now, this is the second time I've seen this movie, and I think it...
I'm the only one who hadn't seen it.
I guess so.
Apparently.
Oh, man.
I saw it when I was a resident because of the obvious geographical ties to it. That's a bit...
Oh, cool.
Well, do we have anything else about this one?
Nah.
There's nothing else to this one.
Taking a dead horse.
Well, now who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters. Yeah, I chose this movie because I probably hadn't seen it since I was, you know, could count the years that I am on one hand. And I'm not bummed that I did it, but it was not nearly as cool as I thought it would be. Everyone that's listening to this has probably seen Ghostbusters, so I don't think it really needs an introduction. I mean, it's basically just the SNL guys get together and have a ridiculous movie about ghosts invading a town.
Yeah, that's about it.
That's pretty much it. Not a whole lot happens. It's just campy fun. All the characters are caricatures of people. The acting's pretty much just there for laughs.
Well, but it accomplished its goal. I had a great deal of fun watching this movie, really.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, it's fairly ridiculous. I forgot how just ridiculous the female is when she gets sort of, you know, possessed, and she becomes all obsessed about the gatekeeper and the keymaker and the keymaster, and it made me think of The Matrix so much. It was so ridiculous. I don't think I could ever watch The Matrix again and just not laugh out loud because it's as ridiculous as Ghostbusters.
Yeah, most of the plot and story and all that didn't really seem fully thought out.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
No, I just think it's funny. I think they probably just made this on a whim, and it became, you know, they made sequels because for some reason people actually went to this movie a lot.
Well, these were big stars at the time. I mean, this was a big movie.
Yeah, I think the SNL cast members used to be a bit more famous than they think they are now.
Bill Murray still.
Bill Murray, yeah, but Bill Murray had to have kind of a career revitalization when he got older, you know? Kind of disappeared for a while.
Yeah, Dan Aykroyd's been talking about Ghostbusters 3 for about 10 years.
Yeah.
That's all he's got.
Yeah. I thought Rick Moranis' character was hilarious. the guy trying too hard and just overanalyzes everything. But that's kind of just how I imagine Rick Moranis as a human being.
Yeah, that character was awesome.
Yeah.
Unbelievably lucky with the ladies, despite his extreme nerdism.
I don't know if you want to call that nerd. I mean, it's just the character's going, you know, he's working as hard as he can to possibly be as ridiculous as possible.
Yeah.
you'd have to try to be as ridiculous as Rick Moranis' character in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of love that there's this all sorts of weird ghost-catching technology that's never explained at all, and then they just magically have this technology and trap ghosts right when they come to town, you know?
There's a lot of stuff like that that would just be impossible and just are never explained.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about Ghostbusters in a serious context because
it's impossible.
It's like a kid's movie, you know, that adults can watch and be okay with, you know?
Yeah, it's clearly for teenagers. I watched it when I watched it. I did it on the big screen at the Tower Theater with a room of about 100 people for this viewing just recently, and that really helped. That and most of the people there were pretty drunk, and there was yelling and quoting lines, and so the movie can be a great deal of fun for people around our age. But if you're looking at it as anything more than that, anything more than fun and maybe some memories if you watched it when you were a kid, then you're going to be disappointed. Because from a technical standpoint as well, there are just so many mistakes, boom mics all over the edges of the frame.
Yeah.
And things like that going on the whole time. But it's fun. So.
Yeah, totally. And it has the Marshmallow Man, which is crucial. Yeah. The Marshmallow Man is so awesome. That's the best idea anyone's ever had. When people think of destroying whole towns of walking creatures, a giant man made out of marshmallows is the best one anyone's ever come up with.
Best monster.
Yeah, he just looks so happy, just causing so much destruction, just running through the town. Indeed. And there are ridiculous amounts of quotable lines in this movie.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying, because I actually... We did, when we did this, a line, let's see, what did we call it? It was a shot scavenger hunt, and there was a list of lines that when you heard any of those lines, you could then take a shot. And there were some good ones.
Wow. That sounds like, see, that would make this movie much more enjoyable. I think I would have rather watched it with you than by myself. You know, it's pretty much just a comedy, and it was made to have fun.
Yeah, I guess the things I wanted to bring up is it felt like to me the character of Winston is completely superfluous. Like, you could take him out of the movie and it wouldn't change it at all.
Yeah, I was thinking that very thing. Like, what is he doing here? He did have a good line, though.
I think that's the point. I think that's the whole point, though, is that he's just some useless character. Is he in the second one? I don't know. I'm imagining he is. Does he have a more developed role in the second one? Ghostbusters 2?
No.
I have the movie and have not watched it since I got it.
Yeah, he's in the second one.
Okay. So maybe, I don't know. I definitely feel like he was probably just a buddy that they would have in this movie. And so they wrote him. You know, there's nothing there except the token black guy. Right.
Kind of, yeah. It's like maybe a producer said, well, we've got three geeky white dudes. We need to spice this up a bit.
Diversify.
A little bit. Because, yeah, I was thinking by the end of the film, it's like he really hadn't added anything to it, and you could have taken out all his scenes and replaced them with other ones, and it wouldn't have changed anything.
I liked his line, you know, and I like that Jesus dude style.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. I guess there was that weird scene where him and Dan Aykroyd are in the Ectomobile or whatever it's called, and Winston's talking about God. That was kind of a weird scene. It kind of felt out.
That was really weird. I agree. It was like it came out of nowhere, and it was almost like trying to flesh out his character. Like, see, he believes something, but it had no relevance to anything else. There was no reason why they'd be having that conversation, and then it ends very quickly.
Exactly. It just felt totally like forced almost. But the editing was really sketchy in this whole film. Did you guys notice the scene where Dan Aykroyd gets a blowjob from a ghost?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually had heard something about that and how that's actually from like a super extended long dream sequence that his character had that ended up on the cutting room floor, but they decided to leave that part in for some reason. And it's in this whole montage of them going out and busting ghosts, and so I guess it kind of fits, but doesn't really.
I'm not so sure getting a blowjob from a ghost ever really fits in.
Yeah, it's like it's just, why would they decide to leave that in?
For humor purposes. Oh, look, there he is.
There's no context behind it, so there's really no joke. You can't just throw out a punchline and expect it to be funny.
But might be. I don't know. I think they can expect that when they're marketing to an American kind of like teenage target audience. I think they probably succeeded on that joke in getting the people they were writing for to laugh, like add in another laugh, you know.
What is hilarious?
I had actually forgotten about that, but.
Well, I mean, I didn't laugh. I just kind of scratched my head thinking, what the fuck is that? You know what I mean? It's like.
That is the proper reaction, I think.
Yeah. And so I guess if that was the point, then success.
That probably was the extent of their reasoning.
I just, it made me more curious. It's like there's a story behind that scene. I would like to know the story behind the scene.
I don't know. I think it's like what Clay had said. They probably didn't want to, you know, they thought they could get one laugh out of that whole dream sequence and it happened to be the blowjob. And so they found a place to squeeze it in.
Yeah.
Probably. You know?
Yeah. Cool. So which of these three is the best ghost story?
Well,
they're so different.
They're all pretty ghosty.
Yeah, I think Empire of Passion is easily the best movie.
I think, yeah, for sure. But it depends on your motivation. From a pure quality standpoint, I think it's the most developed and it's most thought out. The best made, best produced.
Do you want to see a good ghost story, laugh at ghosts, or laugh at people being haunted by ghosts? Your three options with these three movies.
Well, that covers it.
Cool.
To get involved in the discussion, you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/3filmegos, follow us on Twitter, @3filmegos, or email us at 3filmegos@gmail.com. You can also comment at 3filmegos.podomatic.com, where you can also donate and subscribe to the show. Music provided by 90s Television. You can hear more of their music on Facebook. On our next episode, Serial Killers. We've been the 3 Filmegos. Thanks for listening.